physicians like to learn by case study, and we had an opportunity before the show to meet some patients who shared their stories. Our first case study is Jessica, who's been battling a severe case of Crohn's disease for the past few years. Jessica had surgery to remove a blockage and part of her small intestine. We recently visited Jessica and her family in Jackson, New Jersey.
Well, I like to read all sorts of books. I actually was reading the Iliad a while ago, and all my friends thought I was crazy because I wanted to read it, and they all had to read it, but I just wanted to. And I just love to cook.
You wouldn't believe how much flour I got everywhere today.
My dad has been a chef since before I was even born. So food has obviously been a big part of our lives.
How are they, nice and light?
Mm-hmm. Even better than the last ones I made.
Ever since I was little, I always had intestinal problems. I would spend long periods of time in the bathroom, but we never really thought anything of it, or I didn't anyway.
Summer of 2004, Jessica was very sick. Off and on, she would have bouts of flu-like symptoms.
I was achy all the time. I was vomiting all the time. I had diarrhea all the time, and I just generally felt terrible.
After that had been going on for a while, it started to get worse and not go away. And then it dawned on me that perhaps she had Crohn's disease. I suspected Crohn's because of the family history.
When I was diagnosed, not only did I find out that my father had Crohn's, but I found out that his mother's father had Crohn's. And he was treated by Dr. Crohn, actually. We tried all sorts of medication, and it only seemed to get worse. Eventually, I was completely unable to eat. It hurt so much that I just stopped eating.
Well, it was initially discovered she needed the surgery when they were doing the upper GI and small bowel.
We found out that I had a stricture in my intestines. It had shrunk to the size of a telephone cord.
And before the telephone cord, it was bloated out really big like a balloon, because as everything was coming through the intestines, it was being stopped at that point.
Patients with Crohn's disease will sometimes get to the point where so much scar tissue has developed within that part of the intestine that it's literally choked off the intestine or caused the blockage. And when it gets to that point, oftentimes medicine can't help.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Good.
Once it was clear that those were not effective anymore, that's when they called me to see if there's something I could offer.
Now, don't let me hurt you, okay? If anything hurts, you're going to tell me, right?
Mm-hmm.
We could have done it conventionally at our local hospital, or we could have it laparoscopically at a different hospital. And we chose laparoscopic because it was a quicker way of healing, less trauma, less invasion of the body, less scarring. And that was pretty important for, you know, a teenaged girl. It was scary. And I was worried for her, because that was a big thing to kiss your daughter and let them wheel her off to the operating room, and knowing how scared she was. It was a long wait.
We were able to relieve that blockage by removing the segment that was involved, and we were able to do a primary anastomosis so that she can make a full recovery.
When I got home, I started feeling amazing.
It's interesting because patients with Crohn's disease who develop these surgical issues often develop them so gradually that they don't even realize how sick they are or how unwell they feel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then it's after the surgery when all of a sudden the obstruction is relieved and they feel much better. Oftentimes, will feel much better than they have in years.
A couple months into the whole process, she suddenly walked into the living room and said, "I know what I want to be." And I said, "Oh, what's that?"
Since I've been sick, I realized that I would like to become a pediatric nurse, because when I was sick, I saw how the nurses helped me a lot. one day I'd just like to give back and help other kids who have been through the same thing I've been through.
This is really a classic case. A young patient wanting to get on with her life, having complications from stricturing disease. She's given a great option for medical therapy. Her disease is isolated in location. Should have an excellent outcome with surgical resection, and I think that's what she manifests.
I think she raises another issue, and that is young people with Crohn's disease who potentially can go through problems with growth retardation and significant side effects from the medications. So she has a wonderful story, and many kids are approached with surgery options early on because of these potential side effects.
When we're dealing with a situation where we've got stenosis again, and sometimes if we use medical therapy and there's a substantial component of stenosis, scar tissue, we just can't get enough relief to open that up and the patient's going to remain symptomatic. So in this situation, surgery is definitely going to help her. And then afterwards, of course, we hope it's not going to come back quickly. But certainly from a medical person's standpoint, this is the situation where we're looking for a laparoscopic surgeon because these patients oftentimes do well. Young people like this, their incision size is smaller. Young women are happier with that. So it's a great candidate for a laparoscopic operation.
Obviously, when you think about minimizing the impact of surgery, you also want to minimize the number of surgeries. And I know that some surgeons are actually choosing a single-stage procedure when typically a two-stage procedure was really more traditional. What's the thinking on that?
I think a single-stage procedure obviously is ideal, and many patients would like that. Those patients have to be selected very carefully. This is such an important operation in terms of restoring someone's quality of life that you can't afford to have too many mistakes. So we do offer one-stage procedures, but those patients are selected by various criteria. A lot of that has to do with their nutritional status. A lot of that has to do with the medications that they're on. And it also has to do with previous operations or complications that they may have had from their disease process. So there is a select group of patients that are ideal candidates for that, and we carefully choose them.
I think that is key. I mean, the focus of the operation for ulcerative colitis is to restore normal bowel continuity and avoid a permanent stoma and to get excellent pouch function. So to aggressively select these patients is important. And in my mind, this is really the patient with dysplasia, who has not really had active disease and is on virtually no medical therapy. That's really the candidate who's going to get the best result. Patients that are on some of these other immunosuppressive agents, I do have concerns about the single-stage procedure.
It seems there are lots of considerations in regards to caring for patients with inflammatory bowel disease. Is diverticulitis more straightforward, and what are the current recommendations for surgery in those cases?
Well, diverticulitis can really be divided into two different categories, complicated and uncomplicated. So uncomplicated diverticulitis occurs. Patient has left lower quadrant pain, may have some fevers. But the take-home message is they're able to go home. They're usually on oral antibiotics, and they will recover. They don't require hospitalization. Complicated diverticulitis, they may have an abscess. They may have had a small perforation of their colon or a large perforation of their colon. But in any case, they require hospitalization, they require IV antibiotics and a trial of bowel rest. The difference for us as surgeons is uncomplicated diverticulitis can then be managed with lifestyle changes, dietary restrictions, high-fiber diet, and will not likely ever need surgery down the line. Patients with complicated diverticulitis most often will require a resection of that portion of their bowel at some point in the future. Now, the caveat to that is patients who have multiple episodes. So if someone goes home, they get better with the oral antibiotics, and they're back to work, but then a month later they have symptoms again, those are the people that you concern about because we know historically they're going to continue to probably have these problems and they get more serious as time goes on. So those patients may also require a referral to a surgeon for consideration for resection.
I think that's right on target. If a patient has a really severe episode of diverticulitis, or has a complication such as development of a fistula to the bladder, a fistula to the vagina, then the decision about surgery is easy. We do see a lot of patients who will have an episode, it's managed as an outpatient with antibiotics, and then we follow them over time and see what happens. And if they have recurrent episodes, the decision about whether to do surgery is really based on the combination of the severity of the episodes and the frequency of them and how much, sort of disability they have from that. But you'll see individuals who will have one episode and never have another. You'll see individuals who will have an episode that's relatively mild and not have an episode for several years. And so very infrequent episodes that are mild can be managed medically. When they start to stack up on top of each other, or they're quite severe, requiring hospitalization, or the patient can't, get up and go to work for 2 or 3 days at a time, then we need to think about finishing the process by surgical resection.
And I think there's certain populations that are at added risk. Diabetics, at my particular institution, we have a lot of transplant patients who are on immunosuppressions. They tend to require surgery earlier on than the average person.
I think it's important, particularly for primary care, to do imaging at some point, probably with CT scan, because there is also a group of patients that will have similar symptoms and don't actually have diverticular disease, but have irritable bowel syndrome. So I think it's important to document what the disease process is, because then we know how to start the clock in terms of what the treatment recommendations will be. And that other group is the group that's getting on antibiotics every 6 or 8 or 10 weeks. That's a group that probably has never really recovered from their diverticulitis and has smoldering disease. And so that group probably should come to surgery earlier than later.
Is a minimally invasive approach appropriate for diverticulitis, and how does it compare to a traditional open surgery?
Clearly, it's a great indication for a minimally invasive laparoscopic approach to resection. It's a technically more complex operation because there's inflammation, thickening of the bowel, adhesions maybe to adjacent organs, so it can be a more complex surgical procedure for the surgeon. But the benefits to the patient are incredible in terms of faster recovery, return to work, all the benefits that we've alluded to earlier. But because the operation is focused on removing a specific segment of the bowel, the sigmoid colon, it should be an operation that can be more readily applied to the population.
And this is actually one of the great indications for a hand assist approach sometimes, because as complicated as diverticulitis can get, it may be uncomfortable or difficult to perform it purely laparoscopic. So in cases where people have formed fistulas to the bowel, to the bladder, to the vagina, having a hand in there may sometimes assist with completing the minimal invasive approach.